This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
many people were returned basically to locations close to their home areas, but not actually to their homes. So they ended up in, you know, essentially being displaced a second time and compounded the suffering they were already experiencing.
That's Mark Yarnell, Senior Advocate Focus for Sub-Saharan Africa at Refugee International. Details coming up.
Also, disabled people in Cameroon are protesting the deepening crisis in the country's English-speaking regions, and the WHO warns that progress against malaria has stagnated.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, disabled people in Cameroon are protesting the deepening crisis in the country's English-speaking regions after clashes between government forces and armed separatists killed several handicapped people. A number of people caught up in the fighting have been made disabled as well. Their protest in towns across Cameroon today comes after a bloody weekend in which at least 25 armed men and several troops were killed. Moki Edwin Kenziga reports from Yaoundé.
54-year-old Martin Dende was among tens of disabled Cameroonians protesting near the Ministry of Defense Monday against the killing of handicapped people. Dende, who has a hearing impairment for 35 years, went to teach philosophy in the English-speaking northwestern town of Kom in September 2017. He was there for barely a month when armed separatists attacked and torched his school for refusing to close its doors. Ndende says he and several teachers were abducted and tied to a tree. It was a week before Cameroon's military came to the rescue, too late to save his broken right hand, which had to be amputated. Ndende says he is an unfortunate victim of the offensive things armed gangs do to people in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. He simply went to educate children in the restive areas, he says, because true patriots and loving parents would never accept to compromise the education of their children. Even in war-torn countries, children are protected and allowed their right to education, says Ndende. Christopher Ayombe is leader of Cameroon's Coalition of People Living with Disabilities. He organized the protest in towns in the restive regions and Yaoundé to urge both the military and separatists to stop killing civilians, especially the handicapped.
We are going to educate the military services how to engage persons with disabilities in crisis time. We have persons with disabilities who do not hear, and they were shot down based on the fact that they gave instructions and they did not hear. So in such situations, how do you identify someone who do not hear? How do you identify somebody who cannot see?
Cameroon's military says over the weekend, it killed 20 terrorists in Kom, including a separatist general known as Amigo. Ayombe says a blind civilian was killed during the clashes in Kom because nobody helped him escape the shooting. At least 12 disabled people have disappeared during the two-year conflict and are feared dead, says Ayombe. Spokesman for Cameroon's military, Colonel Didier Bajek, says troops do their best to avoid civilian casualties.
Le ministre délégué à la présidence chargé de la défense à chaque étape et chaque fois que l'occasion s'est présentée.
He says Cameroon's defense minister always reminds his military on the need to remain professional even in difficult moments and does not hesitate to punish any soldier found to have abused the rights of citizens. While the military respects the rights of all citizens, says Bajek, armed terrorists who often take drugs attack and kill civilians. Bajek did not give specific examples of troops punished for abuses. Cameroon's military says more than 1,200 people have been killed in the past year of fighting between security and separatists, while hundreds have been abducted. Last week, armed men abducted 16 Roman Catholic nuns in the northwestern town of Kumbu. They were set free and unharmed a day later. Earlier this month, suspected separatists kidnapped 79 students and 3 staff from a school in the northwest. All were released within days. Rights groups accused both the Cameroon military and separatists fighting for the independent English-speaking state of using excessive force. Nearly 250,000 more people have fled the ongoing violence. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Over the past year, intercommunal violence has displaced hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians. A recent Refugee International report titled "The Crisis Below the Headlines, Conflict Displacement in Ethiopia" indicates that at the outset of the crisis, Prime Minister Abiy's administration took laudable action in collaborating openly with United Nations agencies and other humanitarian organizations to mobilize and coordinate a response to the plight of internally displaced persons, IDPs. Unfortunately, however, according to the report, the Ethiopian government has more recently taken steps that have compounded the displaced people's suffering by pressing for their return home before conditions were suitable. Mark Yarnell is a senior advocate focused in sub-Saharan Africa and author of the report. I started out by asking him how big the crisis was and where in Ethiopia was it happening.
There's ongoing displacement in several areas of Ethiopia at the moment. One of the locations most impacted is in the south of the country, along a border area between Oromia and the SNNP region, in a place known as West Guji and Gedeo. And fighting that occurred beginning in April of 2018 and then kicked off again in June with ongoing clashes has led to continuing displacement. But unfortunately, there's also displacement in the west of the country at the moment as well due to intercommunal violence.
So according to the report, the Ethiopian government took laudable action in dealing with the crisis. But your report states that actions taken have compounded the crisis. Can you explain that?
Sure. So at the beginning of the crisis, the government was very essential to try to collaborate with UN agencies and other international organizations and to try to mobilize a response to get immediate assistance to people who had been displaced by the crisis. But unfortunately, before security was restored and before people's villages were rebuilt, the government began to press for people to return home. But because the conditions weren't conducive to return, many people were returned basically to locations close to their home areas, but not actually to their homes. So they ended up in, you know, essentially being displaced a second time and compounded the suffering they were already experiencing.
What conditions should be set or met before internally displaced persons return?
Well, the bottom line is that it should be voluntary, that people should have the choice to decide when they want to return. So I think that the main thing is that the conditions in this circumstance were not voluntary because the government began to restrict assistance in areas where people had been displaced and said they would only receive assistance if they returned. So aid was essentially instrumentalized to induce return. So that's the bottom line is the issue of voluntariness. And then just additionally, if returns are to be sustainable, then yeah, you need basic elements of peace and reconstruction, and those conditions are not present yet.
So what steps the Ethiopian government should take to rectify this? Have they learned their lesson?
At the moment, that continues to be the trend or the policies of the government. And so that's why we're trying to raise awareness about the situation and to sort of highlight the additional damage that it can cause when people are returned prematurely. And as we're learning, unfortunately, there's, as I mentioned, in addition to the displacement in the south of the country, there's also displacement in the west at the moment. And so we want to make sure that the way the government responded in the south doesn't become a precedent for how they respond throughout the country.
What about international organizations like the United Nations? What should they do?
Well, I think they need to keep working with the government and continuing to provide assistance where they can get access. And I think as well that there's a number of experts within the United Nations who work on sort of appropriate policies and approaches to responding to internal displacement. So given that there's, you know, despite some, I think, discouraging policies by the government, there is a good, you know, good engagement between the UN and the government. And so I think the UN has a lot to offer when it comes to providing support on appropriate policies for internal displacement.
And that was Mark Yarnell from Refugees International. He was talking to us from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Disabled people in Cameroon are protesting the deepening crisis in the country's restive English-speaking regions. And over the past year, intercommunal violence has displaced hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The World Health Organization warns that progress against malaria has stagnated. It says a rise in cases, a decline in funding, and increasing resistance to insecticides raises fears of a resurgence in the mosquito-borne disease. WHO reported today that 219 million cases of malaria were reported last year, up 2 million from a year earlier. The disease killed 435,000 people last year, most of them children under five. Globally, 90% of the cases and fatalities are in sub-Saharan Africa. Nigeria accounted for 25% of the cases, followed by 11% in Congo, 5% in Mozambique, and 4% in Uganda. Health officials say they need new tools, innovation, and money to fight the disease.
It's World Toilet Day, and despite the world moving leaps and bounds in areas like technology and medicine, there are still some countries where basic access to clean and proper sanitation is denied to millions of people. In South Africa, there are still thousands of people using pit latrines, most of them being children. From Johannesburg, Yashira Ramprasad has the story.
Nearly 25 years into South Africa's democracy, more than 4,000 schools still use pit latrines. The Department of Basic Education says the legacy of apartheid and a lack of finances are to blame for the slow pace of building proper flush toilets at all schools. The problem affects the poorest of the poor, leaving children to use unsafe and unsanitary pit toilets when they should be focused on using their education to improve their lives. One businessman, Vasi Naidu, has been working in some rural schools fitting a product called Toilet Smart in efforts to help children have access to better sanitation. Toilet Smart is a powder that is poured into the latrines.
You know, it's a list of bacteria that kills and eats the sewage. And another thing, it's also an environmental friendly product, and also for health reasons. It doesn't spread cholera and all the waterborne sewage diseases.
Naidu said the project started because pit latrines pose major health risks to the people using it. The pit toilets are particularly dangerous for children. Many fall into them and get hurt. Some even die.
That's drowning, where they fall into these pits, you know. That's where the children die. But more importantly, also the water becomes contaminated with the sewage. You get, and then you can get all these diseases. the switch, the like I said, the waterborne diseases. You get malaria, cholera, diarrhea, all that comes up with these untreated sewage.
For those living in communities where pit toilets remain, all they can do is hope nothing tragic happens while government, charities and businesses move slowly toward fixing the problem. Yashira Rampasad for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The South African government, led by the African National Congress Party, wants to push forward rapidly on getting more farmland into black hands. Part of that effort could include expropriating land without payment from white farmers, raising fears among white South Africans and many business owners. It is a complex issue that has historical, social, and economic implications. In the first part of a series on land in South Africa, Darren Taylor gives us an overview.
During colonialism and apartheid, racist laws gave whites South Africa's best land. Today, about 30,000 white commercial farmers still own the most fertile ground.
Land dispossession in South Africa was, in a sense, the original sin.
That's Professor Ruth Hall of South Africa's Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies. Since the end of white rule in 1994, the ruling African National Congress has tried and failed to carry out significant land reform. Hall says the law has always allowed for land seizure and restitution.
It does not provide blanket protection of private property. It was always designed with land reform and transformation in mind. It says that the state can expropriate. It doesn't need to pay market price. Any compensation is just and equitable.
Her research shows that less than 10% of commercial farmland has been redistributed. The government has programs to transfer land to black farmers and to offer grants and loans to help them get the supplies they need. But Hall says the budget for reform has decreased in recent years. Her organization's research shows the government allocated almost 3.5 billion rands for buying land for black farmers in 2013, which was down by about 14% from the previous year. And for this year, the budget is down to 2.7 billion rands. And some black farmers say the programs meant to help them have been badly run. Whiskey Khabo, a farmer in northern Limpopo province, was one of the first beneficiaries of the ANC's land reform back in 1996. He says the state gave him land and promised startup funding.
You request 15 million matching the standard of the project, they will give you 1 million. And they say this is first tranche.
But the next loans never came through, leaving him and other new farmers stranded. The issue, says Hall, is how best to use the land. Farming here ranges from small subsistence farms to congested holdings on tribal areas to massive commercial farms, largely in the hands of white South Africans. Thousands of people live and work on those big operations, and they also have a stake in the issue. Professor Ferdy Meyer is the director of the South African Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy. He says a crucial element of determining how to redistribute land is knowing who is on the land now and how it's used. And that data isn't available.
We don't have a comprehensive land audit. We don't have a comprehensive farmer support service. And we don't have a comprehensive understanding of where these farmers are and what their needs are.
The government recently began a census of commercial agriculture to help guide decision-making. It should be done next June. The government has yet to present a plan on how to proceed or a timeline. While President Cyril Ramaphosa has told foreign investors that property rights will be protected, the ANC leadership has said, without other options, it will expropriate white-owned land without payment. Still, the government held listening sessions around the country earlier this year with communities and groups that have stakes in the issue. At those sessions, farmers, academics, politicians, and business leaders discussed the obstacles on the path toward land reform. For the first time ever, says Hall, they engaged in friendly, significant talks about a plan that could change South Africa into a more equal society. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
African Union leaders have agreed on new measures to force members to pay their dues as part of an effort to reduce the body's reliance on foreign aid. Heads of government and senior ministers of AU states spent the weekend in Addis Ababa debating reform plans to streamline the organization. They also approved the creation of a peace fund to be used to keep crises from becoming full conflicts. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, the current AU chairman, was tasked with leading the reform effort. He said any agreements reached would be felt for decades. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhibe in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello friends, this is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic next week will be personal hygiene. This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, new Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is pushing through reforms, including tackling economic mismanagement, fighting corruption, and human rights abuses. An in-depth discussion on Ethiopia's new era on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cata All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.